And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this?
A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy!
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds!
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Athletic.
Lighter, faster, smaller, the story behind its controversial looks and what technology could feature in its successor. I'm Andrew Vandenberg and welcome to a special Gen 3 version of the Race Formula E podcast. Hello everyone, today we are bringing you a bonus episode of the podcast. It's been almost a month since Formula E unveiled its third generation car, which will feature in Season 9 that kicks off later this winter. This is an important car in the evolution of the all-electric series. It's a massive step forward in terms of performance, demonstrating exactly how far electric car racing technology has come since the series launched in 2014. So who better to help us with a deep dive under the skin of the new car than the two of the people who were instrumental in conceiving it? Frédéric Bertrand, FIA Director of Formula E and Innovative Sports Projects, and Alessandra Ciliberti, FIA Formula E World Championship Technical Manager of Motorsport and Sustainability. Welcome both. I hope I got your job descriptions right there. We're delighted to have you on the show. And of course, I'm joined by my regular co-host, the man who wrote the definitive book on the creation of Formula E itself, Sam Smith. Sam, copies of the book still available in all good bookshops?
Yeah, there's a few left. Happy to take orders today if anyone wants to place orders. Yeah.
Right, let's crack on into all things Gen 3. Since unveiling the car at Monaco last month, Fred, what have you made about the reception? Were you aware of the reaction to its appearance was going to be so diverse?
Good afternoon. To be honest, I think more or less people would say that as long as people speak about the project, it's good. So I would say it's good on that side. But diverse, no. As soon as it starts to design and style, anyway, people all have their view and taste. And I would say that so it was not a surprise that people speak, because we were also internally, when we had the first view on those design, discussing a lot. Will it be sufficiently disruptive? Will it be sufficiently able to represent the future of the championship, and being the flagship is important? So more or less, yes, we were ready to have so many comments, and it's good that people react.
Sam, I often think the way that things look in pictures versus the way they appear in real life can be very different. What was it actually like when you saw it in the flesh?
Yeah, I think this is a good case in point, actually. I think when you see it live, it does look more impressive than it does on the, you know, on the printed page, on the page of a website. I think certainly the dimensions are noticeably much smaller. We know that. It's got a really interesting look from the top view down and from the front view. From the side view, it takes a lot of getting used to. I'm not sure it works from the side, but I'm sure that when there are 22 of them or 24 of them next season, that it's no one's going to be really looking at that sort of angle of the cars anyway. I think certainly it could look a little bit exposed on tracks like Berlin because it's super small and has got a smaller wheelbase and so on, but ultimately Berlin is one race that is so different to all the rest, isn't it? The rest of the circuits that we go to in the calendar are tight, bumpy, spectacular street circuits. So I think if you've got something quick enough and you've got something that can race in close proximity to other cars, I think it's going to be pretty spectacular. The drivers were initially quite cool on it, but you know, they saw a car that was in carbon black at Valencia back in November. There was a slightly more positive reaction to when the launch happened in Monaco. And I think, you know, just to reiterate really what Fred said there, I think the aesthetics of the thing is just one quite small aspect. I think these days, as Sebastian Buemi told me when we spoke about it, You know, he focuses on the performance of the car, and you know, a car that is fast always somehow looks good to him, is what he said to me. And I think that kind of encapsulates how people will view the Gen 3 car ultimately.
Fred, the biggest surprise to me was that it was a return to an open wheel look. Has this been due to the way that the drivers have raced with the Gen 2 car? With, you know, there's been a little bit of criticism that there's a bit too much bumping and boring among the field.
Returning to open wheel, it was a mix of different expectations, to be honest. Number one is clearly that we wanted the car to be closer to single-seater standards, to come back to what we know more commonly in single-seater world. And having covered wheels was not necessarily what we wanted to keep. So that was the first topic. Make it more radical, make it more aggressive, make it more single-seater inspired. For sure, it may help us a little bit on policing races, because that will potentially limit a bit some of the contacts we see and we have in some of the races. But that was not necessarily the goal number one. The goal number one was really to have an aggressive look and something which is helping to have a car which is, as Sam exactly underlined, more performant and look more like a single-seater in the look and in the behavior.
What do you think about that, Sam? Is the right move to go back to a pure single-seater design?
From a personal standpoint, I actually really like the Gen 2 blend of single-seater, open wheel, and I suppose you call it prototype look. I thought that was something very unique and innovative. Yes, it brought some problems with, let's say, tactical contact in races and some overly aggressive racecraft, but you know, I just look at what Formula E represents, and it's always, you know, the word disruption is used a lot, and I think that kind of fitted into it for me, the closed wheel look at it. And it's a fine balance, isn't it? You know, you have to have something that represents a, let's call it, monoposto, you know, a single cockpit, single seater concept. But I just thought, again, from a personal standpoint, I just really like that sort of slightly otherworldly look. That's something that you've not seen before, because it captures imaginations and it captures the sort of the essence of what new fans come to the sport for, which is something totally different. Yes, there is a different look to the Gen 3 car, and that will bring more eyes to it in its own way. I just thought it's kind of slightly dilutes the uniqueness of what Gen 2 was building. And I expected something, you know, something on top of that as well. But, you know, the FIA and Formula E have gone another way, and let's see. But what it brings to the racing is yet to be proven. But I think for sure it will discourage some of the, let's say, over-aggressive tactics we've seen, which, you know, have spoiled aspects of the races since Gen 2 started.
Okay, so we've covered off the look, but really that disguises exactly what's gone on beneath the surface of this car. Alessandra, can you explain how we got to that final concept of Gen 3, and in particular the way that there's been a dramatic push to make a lighter car?
Of course. Thanks, Andrew, and good evening, everyone. So as we all know, Formula E is unique in that racing is held on street circuits, and that represents its own challenge. So our aim from the beginning was to design a car which was particularly agile, specifically designed for street racing condition, meaning it needed to be both smaller and lighter. Of course, achieving this implied an enormous effort from us and all our suppliers. We were all faced with the challenge of lightening the car while simultaneously adding components to it, such as the front powertrain kit, as we all know, while also taking a major step forward in power output and region capabilities. But this overall effort from a design and technical perspective was well worth it, because what it resulted to is an evolution that is marking a big step change in the overall car performance compared to the current generation 2 car.
Now, there was speculation beforehand about whether this car would feature a traction front axle system or not. Obviously, you've decided not to go that way. What's the thinking behind that?
Well, we wanted this car to be, both high performance and also challenging to drive to ensure spectacle. Four-wheel drive was discussed at the beginning, but not considered from the outset of the project, especially for the first part of the life cycle of Gen 3. And that is especially because the Gen 3 is already incorporating so many updates as is, and is already packed with many technological high-end solutions. So we are really confident that the current spec with a rear-wheel drive iteration of this car will be successful as is. But of course, we remain open to reviewing this question in the future.
Now, Fred, we've seen some drivers, not necessarily naming any names, Mr. Degrassi, say that maybe the car ought to have been a little bit more radical. What do you think about that?
We are back to subjectivity again. We feel that it's much more radical. I think Sam expressed something really true, is that from picture to reality, you already have a very different feeling of how the car looks. But when you see it in dynamic and you see it on the track, and I had the chance to assist a lot of testing, Alessandra did the same, we really get something radical, much, much more agile, much more interesting to watch, and everything is going in the way we wanted, which is giving a tool to open more possibilities to drivers on the type of track we use and to open a better show. So in that way, for us, it's a more radical car, definitely a more radical car, because it will help racing to be more radical, and it will help racing to be more a better fight and a better show for everyone.
Now, what's probably not really been picked up by the looks of the car and the performance figures is the other really big change, and that's the fact that the tyre supplier is changing. Alessandra, Michelin have been there developing this unique tyre for Formula E, like a treaded race tyre since day one. Now we've got a new car, but also a new tyre supplier in Hankook. And how hard has it been to integrate that, and how good a job have they done so far?
I must say, from the outset of this project, Hankook clearly demonstrated their capabilities, especially in terms of technical and sustainable aspects. And all this was clearly described also in their tender bid. They've shown a strong commitment to this championship from the start. And, we understand that coming into this, highly specialized field in the footstep of a supplier which had the benefit of working in it for the past 8 years is not necessarily, plain sailing. But Hankook rose to the challenge, and they have proven to be fit for the role. And we are very much looking forward to accompanying the team and working alongside them for the next steps to smooth their path and make sure they're well integrated ahead of the start of the season.
Sam, whenever there's a change of tyre supplier, there's always the potential for a change in the competitive order, adding to the mix, a massively radical new car as well. How are the teams feeling about this? There must be an element of nervousness there.
Yeah, I think there certainly was. I think some of the feedback that Spark and the FIA and notably the test driver Benoit Trellier have given on what was achieved during testing has kind of calmed that a little bit. I think Hankook had such a big job to do. I mean, in terms of modelling, there wasn't actually any real, worthwhile modelling that could be done before they went into this deal and made their product. So, the data that Michelin have accrued over the years is substantial, and I think they've done an excellent job. I think Berlin showed that, didn't it? There's just the right levels of degradation and this kind of nuance in how the tyre temperature window was at that track with its quirky asphalt. I thought, gave a really good edge to the racing there. But Speaking to Trelier as well in Monaco, I asked him about the Hankooks and his appraisal of them. And one of the things that I remember from that conversation was that he said that he was deliberately encouraged to lock up the tires and to see how they reacted, which is a normal part and parcel of developing new rubber for such a new project. And he said that the signs were pretty good, that the tires recovered well, and that there was little degradation, which is obviously vital for an all-weather tire and one that is racing on a variety of surfaces that include all the classic racing street racing elements of potholes and drain covers and huge bumps and of course the braking system, which is going to be very, very different with essentially, well, with no rear braking for next year, is going to be super interesting to see how that relates to how the drivers use the tires, how the drivers and teams use the tires. So yeah, I think it was certainly a concern when testing began and before that, but I think actually now the teams are on the cusp of going out to test their development cars, which they received a few weeks ago. So we expect the testing to kick off probably next month, and for them to start learning more and more about it. But I think in terms of an extra challenge, I think it's great. I think there has to be these shakeups in championships, especially growing championships. And we'll have to wait and see how the Hankook product is. But it's going to be a fascinating strand to the Gen 3 story, or the early parts of the Gen 3 story, that's for sure.
We've seen throughout the history of Formula E a desire to push the barriers of what the power units are able to deal with, what the battery can deal with. We saw midway through the Gen 2's car life, the power mode was increased from 200 kilowatts to 220. Alessandra, is this something that we can expect to see over the evolution of Gen 3 as well?
Yeah, indeed. We are, as you know, working hard at the moment to secure the delivery of the product for Season 9. But of course, we're currently also looking at ways to exploit the Gen 3 technology throughout the course of its life cycle over 4 years. And that may not necessarily take the form of increased power as we had in Gen 2, but amongst various ideas we had, we are considering using the FPK, so the front powertrain kit, in traction for specific scenarios. And then we had other ideas which included, for example, an update to the car's bodywork to make it eventually more customizable and enhance brand visibility where possible. You know, there's many ideas on the table. As you can imagine, any evolution comes at a cost. It may be financial or technical, so we have to be mindful of the current development, which manufacturers are ongoing, and ensure that any future evolutions are intelligently incorporated and respecting what the initial brief of this car was.
Oh, that's fascinating. So we could see potentially teams developing their own bodywork / aero parts in the evolution of this car.
Well, I mean, not. What we don't want is impacting creating too many differences in terms of aero performance. That's something we are not looking for. But trying to work around specific features that allow bodywork to be a more customizable and enhanced brand visibility. Yes,
Sam, that's a really interesting potential idea. What else would you like to see incorporated into the next evolution?
Yeah, I think there's quite a long menu for potential things to occur in the second phase of Gen 3. And I know that Alessandra and Fred and Formula E are discussing what might come at the end of 2024 for those two seasons in 25 and 26. I mean, when you speak to, when you gauge the opinions of the people who actually go racing these cars and are involved in the championship, you do get a broad range of preferences. I mean, on one hand, on one side, you've got, we've already mentioned him, Lucas de Grassi, who's got so many opinions about how racing in general, not just Formula E, should go. And I think if you actually take some of those rather than the whole banquet of Lucas ideas, I think there are some good ones in there. But I think certainly, as Alessandro said, you've got to be, you know, you've got to think about the overall health of the championship. And let's not forget that the financial regulations are coming into force next season as well. So that has to be factored in for the future health of the championship. I mean, people talk often about the holy grail of racing, don't they? And that means fully active, four-wheel drive, you know, remarkable kinematics of the car. I think you and I, VW, are old enough to remember 92, 93 era Formula One with those amazing, fully active Williams FW14s and open 15s. And, you know, amazing acts of engineering, unlimited budgets, and everything that you could throw at those cars was on them. They were astonishing. But what everyone seems to have forgotten is that Mansell, Prost and Damon Hill were winning races by 35, 40 seconds.
Racing was absolutely terrible.
Well, of course, that's the other side of it, isn't it? So again, the balance thing, this kind of seesaw of, well, the technology and the racing, you know, you have to get this balance right. And that's the job of the FIA and Formula E. But it's, you know, it's funny what nostalgia does for you sometimes, isn't it? I mean, people talk about that era now. And of course, in this day and age, when sports fans generally, they want instant action all of the time. You know, their attention, their span of attention is smaller than it was 30 years ago. It would just kill the racing spectacle if we had anything approaching what F1 had then. So I think, you can't have the full menu, let's say, which Lucas seems to want. That's quite idealistic, I think. But of course, again, you have to weave into this where the automotive industry is going and what's happening with EV technology, and one eye has to be kept on that. So, to, very roundabout way to answer your question, what would I like to see? I would like to see some identification of the brands. I think if that is done in the right way, some bodywork or some front wing or something to identify the manufacturers a bit more, to give them a little bit more individuality other than their liveries and their brand messaging. I think that makes a lot of sense. I think some element of four-wheel drive, you know, and I'm not the most technical of people, but if there is some element of four-wheel drive that can be incorporated into an Evo version of Gen 3, then that could be fun. But again, that has to be balanced with all the things I've just talked about, plus, of course, the sporting format, which, you know, we've not even discussed yet. So, lots of things are on the page and on the menu there, I think.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
Alessandra, before the break, Sam was mentioning the sporting structure is still yet to be fully defined. Seems to be an assumption that pit stops are coming back and maybe there'll be some element of fast charging or something along those lines. What can you tell us about that?
Well, as you say, the sporting format is yet to be defined, but fast charging is definitely one of the key features of Gen 3. And with this, we really wanted to show the capabilities of high-power fast charging. It was indeed a deliberate requirement, which we included in the technical brief. And for this, we needed to source bespoke cell technologies, which we have defined and selected to handle six 100 kilowatt charge for 30 seconds. That represents, just to put things into context, double the average power that any current road-going car in charging in fast charging yet. So in terms of the overall situation, we are currently undergoing a validation process. We have already accomplished the battery-to-charger integration, and we are working on a car-to-charger integration to happen in the coming weeks. And then throughout mid-June, we are going to do the same with all the manufacturers. They will be able to test the boost charger capabilities with their cars, and that will just ensure correct functioning overall, as well as the full integration of all the safety aspects around it.
Oh, fascinating stuff. I can't wait to see how that will work in action. Fred, attack mode has been an enormous success, despite maybe some of the more traditionalists initially being against it. I think fans now think of it as a fantastic addition. How's that going to work with these new Gen 3 cars?
I think attack mode is one of the perfect example where initial feelings were commonly not necessarily in favor. And at the end, it reveals to be probably one of the exciting part of Formula E and something really part of the DNA of the championship and of the spirit we want to put in this championship. So for the future and for Gen 3, for sure, as Alessandra said, the way we will manage the pit stop, it will be a key topic and it will probably be more linked to activating power and give more power for getting faster. And for sure, we will work also on the way we have to implement attack mode, but more in a 2.0 version, I would say. So this is part of the DNA and we will keep the principles, the way we will implement it, the way we will create the entertainment around this part of the race. Is something we need to keep innovative, is something we need to keep a little bit different from what we currently have. But let's say we will try to keep the best of it and we will try to improve what can be improved in the attack mode, maybe the activation, maybe the way to create strategy around attack mode, where we understand that there is already a lot happening and still keep attack mode as being part of the increase of the show for the fans and also for the drivers, because I think they all now really enjoy attack mode and this part of the race. So definitely it will stay in which form and in which exact form, we will have to define that in the coming weeks.
Sam, a couple of really interesting nuggets there. I think, attack mode has been an enormous boost to the series. Making up really for what was lost strategically when the old car swap changes went away. Now, they were derided initially, but they did add an additional strategic element. Are you looking forward to, potentially the return of pit stops?
Yeah, I am. I think, again, just to reiterate, mixing things up has always been part and parcel of Formula E. You look at where we were. And all the, I suppose, all the naysayers and all the doubters from Gen 1 about the car swaps. And then in Gen 2, it was the attack mode. And, I hold my hands up. I wasn't sure attack mode was going to work. It seemed certainly...
No, likewise.
Yeah, I think a lot of people did. But I actually think it's worked really well. I'd like to keep the attack boost element somehow, even if it can work in conjunction with the pit stop somehow. I'm not sure how that would happen, but I would like to see that stay to some degree. Again, though, it's a bit of a fine balance, isn't it, between natural racing and managing the energy with injecting something, but not too much. So I think you've got to have the recipe right. You don't want to over garnish it, which is something that I think a lot of other series have done. I think often, especially when there are multiple attack modes, sometimes it can get confusing in Formula E. And I say that as somebody who watches it and follows it very closely. So what do the people at home who are watching it, who are trying to follow the racing sometimes? I thought the one hit of 8 minutes in Berlin worked very nicely indeed. I thought they brought a lot to the strategy of the race. I mean, ironically, it probably wasn't as action-packed as the Saturday race, But at the same time, you can get overloaded with what's going on in a 45-minute race. But I think generally it's managed well. I think it gives the drivers and the teams enough strategy play within the race on top of everything else they do to keep it entertaining. And you get this pot boiler, let's call it. You get this kind of brewing up to the end of the race. I can't recall... there's been the odd one. I mean, Evans, I remember, won in Mexico by quite a margin. And obviously the Porsches dominated in Mexico, but that's very much the exception to the norm. You know, usually you do get a race to the flag, and we've seen it literally, haven't we, on occasions in Mexico in 2019 with that race. I mean, it's brought some great sporting moments. But fun re-races, I think... I'd certainly much rather have attack mode than DRS any day of the week. And again, that's an opinion, but I know many others who say the same in the industry. Having something that comes into strategic play and that you have to weave into a race, I think is much more preferable to, you know, having 832 overtakes because of DRS. But again, that's an opinion. I don't think I'm the only one in that one. Ultimately, I think mixing it up and having pit stops will be a good thing, because within a 45-minute race, having that action for a split, let's call it 20, 30 seconds, away from the track, there's so much creativity that the promoters and the FIA can put into a pit stop now. I think certainly there will be things that they're looking at that make these pit stops unlike any other pit stop in motorsport. And I'm looking forward to seeing that, because I think after the testing, which is going to take place in the next few weeks, as Alessandra said, I think once everything is known to be in order and working, I think they can get really creative in making a really terrific sporting spectacle at the start of Gen 3 next January.
Alessandra, with the cars being considerably faster but lighter and smaller, have you assessed what impact this is likely to have on track design? Are the current Formula E tracks suitable for this car, or are we going to have to see some modifications made in order for them to be, you know, showcased in the right way?
Well, we do have worked we have worked with our safety department to check on this, and there was no red flag from the very beginning. We have made sure the performance increase of Gen 3 would cope with existing tracks. It may require some slight change to the safety barriers and various elements required, but nothing that would dramatically raise a red flag for any of the tracks currently in the calendar. Having said that, as Sam said, we are looking at a few crucial weeks ahead of us to validate all the car parameters, and only after that we can certainly say validate what the current calendar features in terms of tracks, and make sure this will cope well with the performance of Gen 3. One thing we can certainly add here is the fact that Gen 3 is strongly track dependent because of the massively increased region capability of this car compared to Gen 2. So we obviously have to keep an eye on that and make sure all the tracks are really suitable for enhancing the car performance and exploit this performance at their best.
Alessandra, sorry, can I just swing back a bit to the four-wheel drive question and that sort of discussion? Is that something that could come into play in the second phase of Gen 3? I don't know, maybe Alessandra and Fred can have opinions on that, because it's something that we get asked all the time, and obviously when we've got some drivers and teams sort of wanting to have that as part of the future, is it something that you consider and could be part of the technical framework in the near future?
If you don't mind, Alessandra, maybe I start,
and yeah, then, of course. And then
you,
go ahead.
You can answer, and you just assist here exactly to the type of discussion we always have, and the way we work with Alessandra is that we try to fix plans which are ambitious, and she tries to make them happen, which is not an easy task all the time, but she's managing that very well. For the four-wheel drive thing, we would love to have a way of activating four-wheel drive in a way or another for the second part of Gen 3. Should it be the start? Should it be for attack mode? Should it be for a specific part of the racing? We don't necessarily think that we should go for full four-wheel drive for all along the race, but we think that if in some phases this could be also part of the addition of performance to the car to make attack mode more demonstrative and even better than what we currently will have without. These are the ideas we would like to check if they are feasible. And as Alessandra said, we also need to make sure that we keep our manufacturers in the capacity of doing it technically and financially. But she's working hard on this one. And then now she can tell you how feasible it is or not.
Well, Fred, I think I can only just echo what you have just said. Absolutely, we are looking into using the front powertrain in traction for specific scenarios in Gen 3. As Fred said, have to be mindful of the current development, which manufacturers are ongoing, and try and make sure any future evolutions around using the FPK in traction is cleverly incorporated into the existing technical brief for this generation of car. But yeah, absolutely interested and looking forward to any future development in this respect.
It seems the wrong thing to ask now, given that Gen 3 hasn't even hit the track. But Fred, I know there were discussions already about Gen 4 in Monaco, and I understand it was quite a positive meeting. What's the roadmap there? When do you have to sort of decide on which way to go? And we talked about four-wheel drive and implementing that here now and keeping track with where road car development is going. What sort of things are likely to be featured in the fourth generation car?
I think Monaco, we had very good meetings on Gen 4 and Gen 3 because we introduced Gen 3 there. But it's always difficult to start to think of the next generation when the current generation is not even on track and we don't have all the feedbacks and all the technical understanding of what's going on and what are the topics we can capitalize on, what are the ones we need to improve. But definitely, we had the chance to have many CEOs there, many manufacturer CEOs coming, many manufacturers which either are interested in the championship for the future or would like to understand more. Many of them who in some cases left and then are already interested in having a look at how things will evolve for the future. So it was a good opportunity to gather them around a kind of a brainstorming. And for sure, the key topics are more or less the one which are now also impacting Gen 3 second phase. Because everyone would like to see those topics happening as soon as possible. But it's true that discussing on how we could include battery into the package of a potential development is something people would like us to investigate. But again, with the clear figures in mind that we don't want the budgets to explode. The second aspect is around four-wheel drive, as we said, or the way to make the car more effective and to make the car even more efficient. And the third is all what has been discussed already previously on the Gen 3 potential brand identity inclusion into the way the car will look like. So these are topics which have been open. There are plenty of other topics which are also discussed, but we really need to go step by step. It was a first, first taste of what could be Gen 4. We will have to, as Alessandra said, first of all, deliver Gen 3, run Gen 3, but we need to define Gen 4, requirements or views for end of 23, beginning of 24 to be able to start to think of the future of Formula E. So it's something which is still far away, but which is coming very fast. So that's why we anticipated that discussion in Monaco. And the good signals were clearly that everybody was on a common agreement on one thing, is that whatever we do, we need to make sure that everyone can do. So we want to make sure that the people and the manufacturers already in place, the teams being part of the championship, will be able to afford any moves, will be able to afford any type of change of or additional strategy elements in the system. And we need to make sure that everybody will be able to be part of the championship for the future within the budget cap which have been given. And I think Sam was right to mention them. This is really, really important for the future, is that we keep the championship under control financially, but we also keep pushing, benefiting from the experience of the previous years, benefiting from the improvement of the technologies, benefiting from additional awareness level, additional communication, marketing packages, which will make the championship becoming even bigger during the Gen 3 generation, so that Gen 4 can even be more ambitious than what we have been for Gen 3.
I think the interesting thing about that meeting in Monaco was that several of the manufacturer big hitters were in town. So Thierry Bolloré, CEO of Jaguar Land Rover, was there. Ashwani Gupta, who's the CEO of Nissan, was there. Carlos Tavares, I don't think, was actually at the meeting, but certainly was in the was in town.
Yeah,
exactly.
And
I think that shows, as well as some of, you know, Frederick won't mention who was there, but we've already written that Audi were there with Alan McNish, and BMW were also represented, plus Lucid Motors had representation there. You've got some real health in terms of manufacturers that are either obviously in and active in the championship or have been active in the championship. And I think the inclusion of Maserati, obviously through Stellantis, and as we know, McLaren as a team, not a manufacturer, but still, again, about to be active in the championship, just indicates that there is a period of... the necessary period of, let's say, a recovery is probably too strong a term, but obviously, you know, when two or three manufacturers leave in the space of 9 months, which happened to Formula E, there is an element of recovery there. But actually, when you see that engagement in the next iteration of the rule set in Formula E, I think it indicates actually that things are on the up, very much on the up for Formula E. So yeah, great deal of positivity in that. One question which I will ask Fred, if possible. I don't know if he'll answer or not, but there were some rumours that slick tyres might be looked at in the future. Fred, is that something that has any credence or any possibility? Could we see that in the future of Formula E?
Honestly, it was one of the topics I personally asked to understand if people could be interested in those moves. And you clearly understand that people have made a big step in Formula E, thinking that we also need to keep sustainability, to keep a consistent strategy on the way we are consuming tires. So for the moment, it's clearly an asset for the championship to have those all-weather tires part of the package, to have those tires which are finally able to deliver very good racing, limiting the number of tires we use per weekend, which is probably quite unique in that way, and maybe not even communicated enough, because it's a clear, very strong thing on Formula E that we are using so few tires for a full event. And at the end, people were not necessarily looking for something which for sure would improve the lap time, but which is not necessarily consistent with the message the championship wants to deliver on sustainability and responsibility towards tire consumption. So yes, discussed, not necessarily something we think as a must if we want to keep consistent with the strategy of the championship.
And if I can add here on this point, as Fred said, he has a sustainable foundation, but also there is an element there to remain road relevant. And what was really raised about this point is, yes, of course, treadless or slick tires would improve traction and therefore the overall car performance. But there was a clear commitment, as Fred said, among all the parties to remain road relevant in this respect.
Yeah, I think if I just to finish, 100% right from Alessandra. So sustainability, road relevancy. And the last thing is, it was more expression of a frustration from some people around the table to say the car is capable of maybe much more than what we show in terms of speed, in terms of efficiency, in terms of lap time. If we were taking some very, let's say, specific decisions, But then we are getting further and too far away from the spirit of the championship, and we don't think it's the right way. So maybe we could go faster, but going fast for and not being relevant in terms of sustainability, road relevancy is not what we look for right now.
Well, thank you very much, everyone. Some fascinating insight there. I genuinely can't wait to see the Gen 3 car out on track. If it performs the way that it's been teed up, it's going to be incredibly exciting. Frederick and Alessandra, thank you so much for your time and for telling us all about that today. But before we go, Sam, I guess we've got a little bit of time to do a quick news roundup. So what's been going on in the world of Formula E?
Well, I think from the last time we spoke, just after the Berlin E-Prix, we talked about the incredible musical chairs in the paddock that was going on with drivers and teams. And I think next year, everybody's going to have to look up at those boards above the pits and just take in the amount of changes that's going to be going on in Formula E, which is all very interesting. We ran a story today linking very strongly Sebastian Buemi with a move to Envision Racing next year as teammate to Nick Cassidy. The assumption being that Robin Freins will leave to drive for the new look apt squad for next season. So yeah, that if that happens, and we believe that it will, and that it was actually formalised in Berlin a couple of weeks ago, that Sebastian Buemi's 8-season run with the same squad with Edams,
it's like the final link to Gen 1.
Indeed, yes, 8 seasons, and you know, an incredible return. 13 race wins is still the largest return for wins that Buemi has achieved. And you know, he had all that success, didn't he? The season 2 season 3, he was dominating the championship, should arguably have had back-to-back titles if it were not for that strange situation with the clashing of the WEC race. But yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see how Sebastian gets on. Obviously, he'll be using Jaguar Power next year. They're a customer, Envision are a customer of Jaguar. So that's going to be very interesting. There's going to be much more stories coming up in the coming weeks with regard to the grid for next season. One of those, we hope, will include the Tichita team, which is surviving or looking to survive for next season. I think its difficulties off the track have been well documented over the last year to 18 months. And I've spoken to both Mark Preston and Keith Mount at the team, and they are more confident than they have been for some time that the team can continue with some new investment and a new structure for next season, which, if comes off, will mean a full grid of 24 cars, which would be a terrific way of terrific way of bringing in the Gen 3 era. We're anticipating some Gen 3 testing potentially next month. I think some group manufacturer testing. I'm sure Alessandra and Fred are going to be at that and seeing and overseeing how some of that activity goes. And the Jakarta track layout, which we have just revealed in the last few moments, actually. On
it's not quite a calendar update, though, Sam. You're not going to get a jingle for this bit.
No, I think we've exhausted the calendar changes for this season. Let's hope we have, anyway. Jakarta, the circuit looks really good, actually. As I said, we were talking before the start of the show. There's a video on YouTube. You can see most of the sort of, I suppose, 90% finished track. I think they're going to be using every hour and every minute up until everyone goes over to Indonesia for the race now, just over a week or so's time. Going to be very interesting. The track looks quick. It's got some undulation, particularly around turn 7. The attack zone is going to be around turn 16 and looks quite quite interesting as well. So, I think there's going to be a lot to look forward to at the first ever Jakarta E-Prix. That's about it. I think there's going to be, like I said, the main thing that's keeping us busy at the minute is understanding who's going to be in which car for next season. So plenty more stories to come in the coming weeks.
I cannot comment on who is going where, but it's true that the activity is amazing. Crazy. Totally crazy.
It's unbelievable. I've never seen anything
It's like it's gone through its own attack zone and is sort of, you know, an extra 35 kilowatts of boost on the whole driver market at the minute. It's great. Good to follow or try and follow.
And we are all four-wheel drive.
Well, Try and keep up with everything that's going on in the driver market on the-race.com. And we're throwing forward to the greatest weekend in motorsport, which is the Indy 500 Monaco Grand Prix doubleheader this weekend, which may even feature a little appearance of me on Sky Sports F1 talking about the big race. So look out for that. Thank you very much, everyone, and goodbye.
The Athletic.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.